This edition of the Monocle Arts Review was first broadcast on the 5th of October 2015 on Monocle 24.
Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Emma Nelson. Today I'm joined down the line from New York by Charlotte Burns, the US news market and business editor at The Art newspaper. We're skipping the big institutions this week. We're heading instead to some of New York's other galleries for a quick whip around of October's must-see shows. We'll begin in a moment at the Matthew Marks Gallery for 5 o'clock Shadow, the largest exhibition of work by Ron Nagel that the city's seen. Then we'll head over to the Tania Bonakdar Gallery for a selection of work by Sarah T, and will end up in Hauser & Wirth for the Superman-inspired art by the late Mike Kelly. So lots to come here on the Monocle Arts Review. Welcome to the show, Charlotte. Let's begin with the largest exhibition of work by Ron Nagel to be shown in New York, 5 o'clock Shadow, on at Matthew Marks Gallery. It's showcasing work by the sculptor, artist and musician dating from the early 1990s. He's a very much an artist who specialises in the small scale but very vivid, bright colours. What's it like to see so much work in one place?
They're gorgeous. I think it's the best show in Chelsea right now, to be honest. Really, really fantastic. I didn't know Nagel's work that well. It's the largest show ever of his work in New York. And they're arranged beautifully. I mean, it's Matthew Marks Gallery, so, you know, they always do things very well. But it's sort of like walking into a very sort of art kind of based jewelers or something, where things are in these small vitrines going back into the walls with really well lit in one set of the exhibition spaces, and then in the other half there's these, you know, glass mounted on blonde wood boxes that the works sit in.
So what kind of feeling do you get when you go to this exhibition?
I don't think I've ever really seen sculptures like this. They're very small. I think Roberta Smith described them as bonsai-like in the New York Times, which is sort of perfect description. They're very small, very inventive. There's some very, you know, there's a couple of themes that, you know, sort of drip through the works. There's sort of longer limbs. There's the kind of idea of the cup or the vessel that reappears in some of the work. But they're not figurative in the sense that, you know, they look like, like a Picasso, like a Giacometti sculpture or something might be more figurative. You see a lot of influences here, like Japanese ceramics, work of Philip Guston. It's sort of like a Californian really interested in hot rods, colour and ceramics in one space, which is an unusual combination.
When he works, he said in the past that he's obsessed with two-dimensionality, which is very strange for someone who specialises in ceramics. And he says he's got an obsession with profiles because he really wants the figures to feel like drawings. And it's only once he's done the drawing of what he wants it to look like on paper then he starts to model. To what degree do you get any of that feeling that he's working in different dimensions as he's making these tiny little sculptures?
Well, I think there are 9 drawings in the show, so you really see that. You know, you see that how his mind works, that it translates these objects from the, you know, two-dimensional paper to the 3D sort of plinth inside this plinth. You definitely see that, and also in a lot of Nagel's writings. He himself is a lyricist. He spends a lot of time writing things down on paper. He works in that way, and you see throughout, you know, he's in his 70s now, and for most of his career there's been a lot of conversation about, you know, whether ceramics is art, and he, I think, has been trying to sort of get away from that for most of his life and just look at ceramics in the same way that a painter might look at a painting. So he doesn't want it to be, you know, a pot must look like a pot. He said that Mirandi was this eye-opening moment for him where he realized that things could sort of be what they were without necessarily representing it, which sculpture has been very much tied to, more so than painting. So I think he looked at some of the ways in which painting was going and took inspiration from that, and more wanted to free himself from that whole debate around whether ceramics is hobbyist or high art.
It is strange. In the past, he said that ceramics is considered to be a second class citizen of the art world. Is that still the perception in the likes of New York?
I think to some extent it is. I mean, it's definitely changing. The show's at Matthew Marks, so, you know, you couldn't really get a... You know, it's one of the best commercial galleries there is. So to some extent, no. And there are a lot of other who, you know, have incredible recognition on the international stage, like Ai Weiwei, for example. However, there are always articles written by publications like ours and, you know, others about, you know, whether this is the moment for ceramics. I think those kind of articles have been popping up every few years, probably for seven decades. So it's still not totally secure in the sense that people still discuss ceramics in this slightly off-kilter way, because people aren't sure whether it's decorative or whether it's, you know, hobbyist or whether it's really serious. There's something less masculine about it than, you know, hefting huge clumps of clay around the place. So I think it suffers a little bit from that somehow.
It's interesting that it's reported that he sells well in Europe. Do you think, I mean, you mentioned there that New York is coming round to ceramics in general and to him. Do you think he will be finding a new market at this time in life in his home country?
I think that's an international thing. I don't think Europe's necessarily more progressive than America in that sense, that artists do very well, but there's still a lot of discussion about the place of ceramics and the role of it. It's also not that unusual for Californians to have done a lot better in Europe traditionally than they have in America. I'm not sure why that is, whether America's so East Coast centric that the West Coast is often overlooked, but artists like Paul McCarthy have always found more favor in Germany than they have in New York, typically, up until the last decade or so. And that's changing. And the great exhibition at the Getty a couple of years ago, the Pacific Standard Time, sponsored and did 10 years of research into art of the West Coast. That did a lot, I think, for Californian artists who had sort of been neglected, I think, by the more East Coast located artists. You know, the Abex artist did a little bit better than the Finnish Fetish artist, for example, which Nagel's sort of associated with, that idea of the finish of the work.
Well, 5 o'clock Shadow is by Ron Nagel, is on at Matthew Marks Gallery until the 24th of October. Let's move on now, Charlotte, to the Tanya Bonakdar Gallery, where the American artist Sarah Tsi has a multimedia show that investigates the value we place on objects and how things might give meaning to places that we live in. Large-scale stuff here, Charlotte. Tells us a little bit about what's on show here.
Well, it's a large-scale show in the sense that it takes up the entire gallery and several rooms at Tanya Bonakdar in Chelsea, but it's also very small-scale. A lot of the work that Sarah Tsi does is, she's very inventive. She sort of creates these ecosystems, and each work is a sort of delicate balance of small, fragile things alongside, you know, I don't know, a ladder or something. She takes everyday objects and places them around with a degree of randomness that's incredibly accurate. She took a month to install this show and went around sort of balancing, you know, there's a lot of objects that sort of are one end and wobble around a little bit, paint on the floor, there's a lot of torn up photographs, dried paint strips, bottles of water, sort of water fountain I think I saw at one stage, torn up photos with images of birds flying across them, plants. It's a real mix of objects that you see in a Sarah Tsi show, and she sort of wants you to go through this, through the exhibition, I think, with sort of randomness and serendipity. I think that's how she installs her show, where she sort of goes around and noodles with it for a month and then says, okay, it's done on opening day.
It's an astonishing idea to think that there is an artist who takes a whole month to install her exhibition, right up until the last minute. I think she said when she was installing this, why wouldn't you change everything up to the last minute? And then once it's done, as you say, she doesn't touch it again. When you're going through this very precisely arranged chaos, what impression do you get? It's being built as an exhibition that helps us to explore how things give meaning to places. Does that make sense to you when you're in the exhibition?
Not really. I don't think that makes sense to me. I think more with Sarah's work, you have to question it because it's so unusual looking. Her installations are so well conceived. There is a sort of inner compass to her work that directs it, and you do get a sense of that amongst this other sense of it being slightly random. There's an organization that comes from her only, that she sort of sees things, and that does make sense. I don't know if it's so much about the places, it's often to me more about the fragility of things and, you know, the fact that in any second, you know, if somebody just sort of knocked over one pile of dirt, then that installation would be ruined. Or there's, you know, lots of very unsteady material. There's a lot of, you know, grains of sand or objects on the floor that you have to crouch down and look at. I think it's more that it makes you, it's less about the places, more that it makes you question the way, it makes you look at things in a different way. I think that's what good art does, and that's what Sarah tries to do in her work, is to force you to take a slightly different viewpoint of something you've seen 1,000 times. And, you know, and there does seem to be sometimes more of a thing of, you know, she has a work in here where she's kind of taken data from NASA, and there's a particular NASA ship that's sort of flying around the, well, there's a countdown that's live and in real time. And meanwhile, as you see that, you also see in a video piece lots of things being exploded like an apple. And, you know, to me, that sort of suggested this idea of, you know, the world's ecosystem and the way in which it's sort of utterly futile to try and go into space and understand the complexity and gravity of that. And, you know, maybe the way in which we're not handling the sort of climate and the world in the very best way whilst we're off there exploring space. But I think you could see whatever you want, really. She's very open. I don't think she's didactic.
Well, this is her first exhibition, her first major gallery exhibition since she represented the United States at the Venice Biennale 2 years ago. It's now on show at the Tanya Bonakdar Gallery in New York City until October the 17th. Tanya Bonakdar being the gallerist who represents Sarah Tsi. Finally, Charlotte, let's go to House on Worth's New York Gallery for a rather colourful exhibition by the late American artist Mike Kelly. On show is an installation reworking the imagery surrounding the comic book hero Superman, including models of Kandor, the capital of planet Krypton. Where do you start with this?
Yeah, so Mike Kelly was, you know, one of the most influential artists of his generation, who sadly committed suicide fairly recently. He spent a huge amount of time towards the end of his life obsessing over this legend of Superman, and especially the city of Kandor, which before Krypton was destroyed, the arch-villain Brainiac seized Kandor, which was the capital city of Krypton, and put it and all of its inhabitants into a bottle. Superman managed to get that away and was unable to restore it to its original size, so kept the bottle with all the inhabitants in his Fortress of Solitude, Superman's hideaway. And he kept a supply of, you know, kryptonite air going into it because the Earth's atmosphere was too toxic for the kryptonites. I think that's what you call them, the people who live there.
I shall absolutely believe you, Charlotte, because I am no expert. It's an astonishing narrative that you've just presented us with. It feels as if you require some prior knowledge before you go into this exhibition, which is incredibly vivid. And many are arguing that this is his one of his most challenging projects yet.
I think you do to some extent. I mean, the prior knowledge helps, and also it's sort of fun. You know, anything around Superman is always quite fun. But I don't know that you need to understand, you know, the legend of Superman entirely for this, because you do get the main themes with much of Kelly's work. He's grappling here with the issue of loneliness. So Superman makes sense in that context, in the sense that he was a conflicted, you know, hero who was living on Earth as a normal sort of average Joe person whilst, you know, keeping from his friends that he was really a superhero, and often spent a lot of time on his own feeling isolated from his home planet, which is in a bell jar in his, you know, sort of attic, essentially. So I think with Kelly, you know, there's that relates to his work. Kelly was this sort of very inventive genius who suffered terribly from depression, often felt isolated from the world, and, you know, torn between these two poles of order and chaos oftentimes. And so in a way, the inhabitants of the bottle represent that kind of order. And you know, there are other elements in the show. There's a video work in the Hauser & Wirth show that seems to suggest more the, you know, utter breakdown of human behavior, and Kelly sort of often straddles these lines of looking at both without ever seeming to suggest a happy middle ground. And of course the show's quite beautiful. Like, when you walk in, there are a series of these bottles that are lit in all these candy colours. It's a very dark room, and so, you know, there's these sort of pinks and orange and blues. So it glows in this lovely way, and then you walk into the, you know, exploded Fortress of Solitude, which is an installation you walk inside, a sort of cave that you go into where the big Kandor bottle is with all the inhabitants around it. And that's kind of incredible, just to walk around and see this thing. I don't know you need to understand it, because there's an effect that the art has on you without a knowledge of the story, I think.
Charlotte, you've convinced me. You can see Mike Kelly's work for yourself at Hauser & Wirth in New York City until October the 24th. Well, that brings us to the end of today's show. My thanks to Charlotte Burns. Thank you very much indeed for joining us, as always, on the line from New York City. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review. This is Emma Nelson. My producer was Holly Fisher. Warm thanks to her. Join us again at the same time tomorrow when the broadcaster and DJ Nick Luscombe will be in the studio for our weekly music review. But for now, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.